Right now, we're looking at yesterday's election results in the race for superintendent of public instruction. Incumbent Tony Evers placed first in the primary election, which means he'll be running against voucher advocate Lowell Holtz in the April 4th general election.
Peter Goff joins us now to talk about the result, what it could mean for education in Wisconsin. He's an assistant professor in the School of Education and in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. Peter, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, let's start. This is not one of the most high-profile races out there. 8% turnout, I think, is what I heard. How influential is the state superintendent of public instruction? How much of a difference do they make to what happens in education here in the state?
In Wisconsin, the superintendent's going to have quite a bit of control, especially in terms of charting policy and determining how policy is implemented. That's even policy that's set with the legislature.
And this is technically a nonpartisan election, but like a lot of races here in the state for Supreme Court, for example, it ends up being a left-right Democrat-Republican proxy battle. Can you look at the two remaining candidates now, Lowell Holtz and Tony Evers, and talk about how they fit in on that spectrum?
Sure. Lowell Holtz is definitely more to the right, proponent of vouchers and parental choice. But he's a little bit interesting insofar as Holtz had advocated for accountability, but now is advocating for reduced testing. And when we think about what it means to start funneling private dollars into or public dollars into private schools and removing that accountability option, giving the parents the choice to let students opt out, it gets a little bit fuzzy on the simple sort of left-right political spectrum. And in contrast, Dr. Evers has been, I think, in his actions, he's been more centrist. He's definitely an advocate for the students, but he's definitely backed by some of the left-leaning organizations, especially the teachers unions in Wisconsin that are concerned about the potential privatization of the schools.
Historically, have we seen education as politicized as it is now, where certain policy positions are the property more or less of the left and the right, of the Democrats and the Republicans?
Sure, that's definitely been the case nationally. Education tends to be a place that where people can reach across the aisle, but there are issues, I think, in Wisconsin, particularly Act 10, has politicized education considerably. And then the voucher program in general, and the expansion of the voucher program by Walker, has further politicized that. And I think having Holtz kind of take that side that has been so strongly advocated by the right definitely lends the political element into this election.
Now, this was not a huge election run-up here in terms of campaign ads and things like that. Do you think now that the slate of candidates is set that we might see more of that? People are looking at maybe national groups that support various kinds of school choice may start to weigh in with advertising money on this race?
I think that's definitely a possibility. I think some of that money was withheld as we tried to figure out who's going to take the number two spot to challenge Evers. There's enough interest nationally and beyond Wisconsin to see external money funneling in to see if Wisconsin can become a further champion for vouchers. We already have a voucher program that is set to expand drastically given the right opportunities. So there is definitely the potential to have that sort of external influence in the funding. So being able to look at who's funding the candidates will be very interesting, and where that money is coming from. To what extent is it local in Wisconsin or coming from beyond? And I think for Holt, it's particularly interesting because one of his talking points tends to be that he's a fan of local control, which is a kind of another code for the voucher argument, or can be, that the parents are making these sort of decisions. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out if he's getting a substantial amount of his funding leading up to April from outside of Wisconsin, and what sort of implications does that have?
You know, vouchers and school choice get a lot of attention when it comes to elections related to schools. Are there issues out there that you think maybe should be talked more about when it comes to Wisconsin schools that maybe don't get as much attention?
That's a absolutely wonderful point. The charters and the vouchers, they're great talking points. Everybody has an opinion on them, but they do educate a very, very small minority of our overall population. When we were Nick Hillman and I were on the show 2 weeks ago, we were talking about overall finance reform, and that's one of those topics that doesn't necessarily have as much immediate media appeal, a frenzy, maybe some of these other topics, the accountability, testing. But it's definitely, when you think about funding, it's one of those aspects that hits every single student in Wisconsin, unlike vouchers or charter schools. One of the issues with vouchers is that it pulls money away from all the other students. It also had the potential impact to allow our populace, our constituency, to self-segregate, which has there's sort of educational risks, and there's also sort of democratic risks that we want to keep in mind. But I think these are definitely the bigger talking points that we could sort of refocus would be well worth our time.
We're talking to education expert Peter Goff now about the results of yesterday's primary election for state superintendent of public instruction.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think of yesterday's election results? How would you like to see education change here in Wisconsin? Which candidate do you think you're going to back and why? And if you're an educator in this state, how are things on the ground? What do you see? Call in now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a few minutes. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farad.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our discussion now about yesterday's primary election for State Superintendent of Public Instruction with Peter Goff from UW-Madison.
Taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. What did you think of yesterday's election results? Tony Evers, Lowell Holtz, both still in the race in the runoff for April 4th. What candidate would you like to see win and why? What do you think of education as it stands in Wisconsin? What, if anything, should change? What should the priorities be for the next Department of Public Instruction supervisor, for the legislature, for local school boards? How are things going in your local district? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Peter, in many places around the state, school board elections, primaries were on the ballot. Can you talk about the role that school boards play in setting the agenda, charting the course for a local district?
Sure. In particular with this upcoming election, any district that is going to have a school board election is going to have a higher turnout than the districts that aren't having a school board election. So when we look at which of you asked earlier about where those dollars are going to be targeted for funding, for advertising, probably see them spent a little bit more so in those districts that also have the school board members going up. You get a little bit more bang for your buck in that regard. The role of the school board has actually changed quite a bit since the advent of the revenue limits. So the school boards used to be able to set the amount that was being spent in any given district. And now with revenue limits, that has to be voted on and passed in a referenda that's district-wide. So that really took a lot of the control of school boards that used to be very integrated with the community and placed it with the community broadly. So the role of school boards has very much changed, and now they're much more integrated into the district itself, focusing on instruction and operations and sort of supporting, as it may be, the superintendent of the district.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Dan joins us in Menominee. Dan, hi.
Hi there. Well, I am a teacher, actually, and so I can tell you that the past few years have been a little bit frustrating for us. Districts that have been fiscally responsible have also come under attack. One of the big frustrations is seeing a lot of our public money go towards private schools, and I think this has led to a very visible teacher shortage. It's getting harder and harder to lure young people into the profession.
Dan, thanks for the call. This is an issue people have raised, especially, Peter, in rural districts. I'm hearing a hard time recruiting teachers. Also, the pipeline of teachers, people going into education schools, maybe slowing down a little. What do you see there, Peter?
So this is a major line of research that we've been looking into over the last year in Wisconsin specifically, this idea of the teacher shortage. One of the things we're seeing is that there isn't substantial evidence for a shortage of teachers. Shortage implies that that there just aren't the people there to fill the jobs. But what we're seeing is that there are people there, although you're absolutely right that we're seeing a decline in the number of people going into and enrolling and applying to teacher education programs. But we still have enough people graduating to fill the vacancies. We have trouble retaining people, and there are specific districts that have trouble attracting them. So it's not so much that there's a shortage. We can think about it as a supply side and a demand side problem, right? Sometimes the problem is that some particular districts have a hard time attracting people that are there. And other times we can think about there are just not people for those vacancies, like when we think about the high demand jobs, like the tech ed positions. And the agricultural education positions, there's very few people certified in those positions. And we do, in that case, we do have an actual shortage. But there are staffing problems broadly across Wisconsin. And I think the caller brings up a very good point. Act 10 really demoralized a lot of teachers and aspiring teachers, made it feel punitive. And we're definitely feeling the ripples of that in the education field.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dan. Peter, an issue that's come up a lot on this show and elsewhere, educational achievement gaps, especially racial achievement gaps. What kind of things are out there? What kind of tools are out there for the next superintendent of public instruction, whoever that may be, to try to tackle those gaps?
That's a great question. It's definitely one of those million-dollar questions that everybody's seeking for, that sort of grail, the silver bullet. But it's elusive and it's challenging, and at the end of the day, it takes a lot of work. We have some folks in our department. Colleen Capper is doing some wonderful work just working with teachers on the ground, looking at these factors such as you can think about how students are assigned to classes. And systematically, there are times, even unintentionally, when certain groups of students consistently get less experienced teachers, less likely to be certified, and so forth. And when those things, when it happens occasionally, it's not necessarily problematic. But when you look at it over the course of a student's educational career, these factors aggregate and put students at a systematic disadvantage. So a lot of these resources and strategies happen right on the ground, right at the school level, right at the district level. And what we can expect from the state superintendent is to put policies in place and put dollars dedicated to these strategies and the time and the resources, human and financial, to put these policies into place.
We'll leave it there. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Peter Goff, assistant professor in the School of Education at UW-Madison. He joins us to talk about yesterday's primary election results and the road ahead for the state superintendent of public instruction.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Ailette Waldman was at the end of her rope. She'd struggled with wildly swinging moods for years and had tried everything to find a fix, from psychiatrists, therapists, SSRI medications like Prozac, sleep aids like Lunesta, and a sampling from the world of alternative therapies available in the Bay Area of California.
So she decided to try something different. She heard about how microdoses of the hallucinogenic drug LSD might help people like her. And she writes about that experience in the new memoir, A Real Good Day, How Microdosing Made a Mega Difference in My Mood, My Marriage, and My Life. Ayelet Waldman joins us now. Ayelet, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, you write about how you're what your kids call totally basic. You say you wear yoga pants all day. You post pictures of your desserts online. And then plus,
yes, I do. And of my dog. I have a very
dog
puppy-heavy Instagram feed.
You taught law, too, at UC Berkeley. So maybe you don't seem like the most likely person to experiment with microdoses of LSD. How did you decide this was something that you wanted to try?
Well, you know, in my previous life, before I was a writer, I was a law professor, and I was also a criminal defense attorney, and I worked a lot on issues of drug policy reform. So I knew a lot about drug policy reform from a criminal justice perspective, and I had been suffering for many years from a mood disorder that was actually very well managed until sort of a while before this happened. My mood disorder is a version of PMS called premenstrual dysphoric disorder. It's basically PMS on steroids. And the medication regimen was very clear-cut and very effective. It involved using antidepressants for 1 week a month. But when I no longer was able to predict my cycle with any accuracy, I kind of fell off the rails, and I became more and more and more depressed. And none of the traditional medications prescribed to my psychopharmacologist were working. None of the therapeutic modalities were working. And eventually I found myself suicidal. And I have a very large library of drug policy-related books. And I noticed on my shelf a book that I had not really looked at before. I don't even know if I bought it or if it arrived at my house. But it was a book on psychedelic drugs. I had very little experience with psychedelic drugs. I actually knew much less about them than I knew about other drugs for my work when I had been writing briefs on behalf of the American Public Health Association and the AMA. I was writing about stimulant drugs like cocaine. I just really didn't know very much about psychedelics at all. And there was this book, and I was leafing through it, and it had a chapter about microdosing. And I then went online and looked at some videos of the author giving a lecture where he described that the experience of microdosing psychedelics is not, you don't trip, you don't hallucinate, you don't have any perceptual differences. What he said was that at the end of the day, people who microdosed looked back on their day and they said, huh, that was a really good day.
And this is Dr. James Fadiman introduced this idea.
He's not the first person to come up with the idea, but he's definitely the person who popularized it. And he's now collecting, anecdotal reports of individuals who've microdosed. And when I heard Dr. Fadiman say that, I mean, I actually rewound it and played it a number of times on my computer because it had been so long since I'd had a good day. The very idea of a good day was almost foreign to me at that point. I was really kind of anhedonic. I had not experienced any kind of joy or pleasure in my life in a long time. And I reached out to Dr. Fadiman, and he was very generous and spoke to me and gave me a lot of information about microdosing and about, the risks and rewards and relative safety. And I finally decided that, I was desperate enough to give it a shot.
And so tell us what we mean by microdosing. I think that, that's not something that is in the popular vernacular yet. What does it mean?
So a microdose is a small dose of a drug, and you can microdose with any drug, legal or illegal. It's a dose that's so small that you don't experience any perceptual effects, but it's large enough that you experience some kind of metabolic effects. So in the case of microdosing LSD, a typical dose that someone would take to, say, trip, like if you're at a Grateful Dead show, for example, might be between 100 and 200 micrograms, not milligrams, micrograms. So a typical dose for someone who wants to microdose is 10 micrograms, between 5 and 10% of a typical dose. For if you want to hallucinate. And it's very small. Like if I said to you, hey, I slipped some a microdose of LSD into your coffee right now, you wouldn't notice any effects. You might, at the end of the day, you might think, wow, that was a really good pledge drive day. That worked out really well.
So this was not something that was without hurdles. For instance, how do you procure
a
little bottle or some sort of microdosable version
hurdle.
Of LSD? So what did you do?
Especially if you're neurotic and the kind of person who can't get the wrong change at the grocery store without returning it and who, has a heart attack every time she gets a parking ticket. Yeah, it was not without hurdles, let's say. Well, when I decided to do it, I didn't know any, not only did I didn't know any drug dealers, I didn't know anybody who was using LSD. I live in Berkeley, California. I thought it would be easy to get it. I thought that, this is like psychedelic birthplace. I thought I was going to go out in the streets and orange sunshine was going to rain down on my head. But in fact, the Venn diagram of people like me, PTA mothers and not literary novelists, and the sort of the portion of that Venn diagram that's LSD users, it's not a Venn diagram. It is just two circles next to each other, not touching. So I couldn't find any LSD anywhere, and at first, Fadiman says in his book, be discreet when you're looking for it.
Well, it's illegal.
I tried discretion. Yeah, it's illegal. discretion. I couldn't be discreet. Nobody, nobody had any LSD. And finally, I just started asking literally everybody I knew. Most people thought I was crazy and were like, no, of course not. I don't have any acid. But one guy said to me, I have heard about this microdosing thing, and I heard about, a friend was telling me about this professor, I don't know where, somewhere in the Bay Area, who's very, very old, who's been microdosing for decades, and maybe he has some extra. You know, the guy's not going to live much longer. I mean, he's like in his 90s. Maybe he has some that he could send you. And I said to him, that is just a stupid story. That is not a real thing. That story is just an urban legend. There is no professor who's been microdosing for decades who has extra LSD for me. So I just continued my fruitless search for illegal drugs until one day I went out to my mailbox, and amidst the sort of Bed Bath & Beyond and Victoria's Secret circulars and, I don't know, my PG&E bill, there was this little brown paper package covered in what I have to say were very old stamps, like stamps from the 80s and 90s, and the return address read Lewis Carroll. And when I opened it up, there was a tiny little cobalt blue bottle in it with instructions for use.
Wow, so that was it. You had your little bottle.
Yes, that was my little bottle. Now, I'm not an idiot. I don't just drink things that show up in my mail, even if they are, you know, even if they do have the return address.
Right, you tested this first. I couldn't believe you got a test from Amazon. That's how easy it was.
That's how easy it is to get an LSD test. I ordered a test from Amazon. It came Amazon Prime. I tested the LSD. I was very careful. You know, I have four children ranging in age from 13 to 22, and I have a very specific approach to drugs with my kids. My rule is no dying on my watch. So I have kind of a harm reduction approach to drugs with them. We give them a tremendous amount of information. We trust them to make good decisions, but we also do things like, you know, provide drug testing kits so that in the event that someone decides they're going to use a drug like MDMA, they first test their drugs, because there have been a series of fatalities and near fatalities of kids who thought they were using ecstasy or Molly, and what they turned out to be, they bought pills that were something else entirely, something far more toxic. So, you know, I was familiar with this concept of testing one's drugs, so I just decided to do it myself. And I just Googled, where do you buy an LSD testing kit? And there in my Google results was Amazon.com, Prime shipping.
And Ayala, we got to fast forward a little bit here because we don't have enough time. This is a great story that you're telling, but I want to get to the day you took it and what happened. This is something you did for a month, and you documented along the way. How did you feel? How did your body feel? What was your sense of health and wellness? But tell us about that first day. Was it a really good day?
So the thing to know is that the day before I was literally standing in front of my medicine cabinet, assessing what was in it and how useful the medicines in my medicine cabinet would be for killing myself. I was suicidal. I was Googling the effects of suicide on children. It was a very bad time. And the day that I took the LSD, the next day, at first I noticed nothing. And then I sat down and got to work. I was sitting at my kitchen table, and I looked out my window, and my dogwood tree was in bloom. And I thought, oh, look, the dogwood tree is in bloom. It's so pretty. It wasn't like the blossoms weren't, you know, multicolored, and I wasn't hallucinating. It was just that I was able to notice the beauty for the first time in so long, when for so long everything around me seemed grim and sad and full of despair. And suddenly there was this blooming dogwood tree, and I could see how beautiful it was. And then the rest of the day felt like that. Like I could see my life for what it was, the joys, the pleasures of my family, of my loving husband, my children, who I'd been so, like, you know, depression clouds your view of the world. And that gave me clarity. And it was really amazing. I mean, I am not exaggerating when I say that I believe that the microdosing saved my life. But then, of course, I don't know that what I experienced wasn't just the mother of all placebo effects, because, of course, nobody has studied microdosing. We do have research on LSD and psilocybin that seems to indicate that they're both very helpful in treating depression, Those are, psilocybin is the ingredient in magic mushrooms. So we know that psychedelic drugs can be useful in treating depression, but because no one studied microdosing, we don't know whether what I experienced was a placebo effect, but I'm just so grateful for whatever it was, because I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't had that month.
And eventually, you know, the month was up, your little bottle of LSD ran out. And having gone through this experience, just briefly as we wrap up, Ayala, what is your take on the stance that we as a society take toward hallucinogens like LSD or even other substances like marijuana?
Well, I think we are hypocrites as a society. So many people take antidepressants. So many people medicate with alcohol. You know, it makes no sense to criminalize certain drugs and not criminalize other, because we're not criminalizing necessarily the drugs that are the most dangerous. I mean, when I was evaluating my medicine cabinet to see what could kill me the fastest, the most toxic substance in my medicine cabinet is Tylenol. Because an overdose of Tylenol will kill you faster than an overdose of anything else I had in there, because it's so liver toxic. So I think research is our friend. And I believe in a science-based approach to things like drugs, to all things, really. And I think we should be encouraging research into marijuana, encouraging research into psychedelic drugs, to see if there are any medicinal and therapeutic if they have medicinal and therapeutic value, if we could not, you know, the idea that there are people in pain who are not getting potential remedies breaks my heart. You know, at every event that I do, I have a bunch of people who come up to me and they say, I microdose, and they very loudly and proudly tell me about microdosing with LSD, with psilocybin. And then I have another group of people who come up to me and pull me aside and confess with shame and despair that they are depressed or they're anxious or they're bipolar. And the idea that we live in a society where you have to be more ashamed of being mentally ill than you have to be about using an illegal drug breaks my heart. And I, you know, this book doesn't say use illegal drugs. This book says let's do the research. Let's study these different chemicals. Let's see if we can get any benefit from them. And let's have a saner approach to drugs and drug policy, so that we aren't incarcerating millions of people, but rather we're thinking about what are the public health consequences of various substances.
Ayala, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure, and I hope you guys raise a bundle during your pledge week.
Thanks a lot. Well, that was Ayala Waldman, novelist and memoirist, and she's the author of the new memoir, A Really Good Day, How Microdosing Made a Mega Difference in My Mood, My Marriage, and My Life.